Hi, this is Mike Miller, and you're on the Harmony Street Show. And this week, my guests are a special treat. I have Sandy Dean, Mr. Howie Kane.
How are you, Michael?
And Jay Renke, the new Jay for Jay and the Americans. And let me just say that it was such a pleasure to see you guys and work with you on stage over the last couple of weeks with the shows that we did up in St. Petersburg and at Nova University. I felt I was doing backstage a night at the Improv because you guys were so funny and so zany and just kept it so upbeat. It was great.
We have fun on stage. There's no question about that.
Oh, I know. I mean, it's wonderful. And, you know, what I really got a kick out of, and that's just to cut right to the chase, is that in such a humble way, Jay, you approach the situation as having to fill the shoes of a Jay, which is very, very difficult. And you said, you know, give me a shot at Karamea and then just tell me how you like it. And, of course, you got a standing ovation, and you certainly got one from me. I was already standing at that point, but it was fabulous. It was just fabulous.
Well, I appreciate that. I really do. But, you know, I'll tell you what.
Go ahead.
I'm firmly of the belief it's a team effort, and it's like I don't take one thing away from these three guys.
Oh, for sure, because they have an awful lot of time invested, you know, in the Americans. You know, really and truly, the Americans are Americana. I want to go back to the beginning with you, Sandy, and Jay, you can listen along too, although I'm sure you've heard the story a bunch of times. Tell me, it's 1959, and the Harbolites are getting together and doing some recording, and I came across a tune called Is That Too Much to Ask?
That's right, yeah.
Too much to ask.
What will I do without you?
Was my girlfriend Sadell.
Right.
Being lead.
Right.
And that was Kenny Vance and I.
Right.
Everybody thought it was three girls.
No kidding. Well, I could see that.
You know, and a couple of friends of mine from Brooklyn thought it was the Fleetwoods.
Right.
And then the song, I wrote the song, that was the song I wrote.
Right.
That got us our first record deal. And we were managed by a guy named Jim Gribble.
Yes, I know who he is.
Jim Gribble was like the matriarch of Matt Duop managers in New York City. He managed the Mystics, the Passions. He managed the Harbor Lights, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He managed the Two Chaps.
Right.
He managed everybody. He was managing everybody that hit the streets.
Right.
A guy named Stan Vincent.
Big Jim Gribble.
Yeah. Big Jim Gribble.
Right.
6'5", and a wild man.
Right.
So anyway, he was managing... he was managing the Mystics.
Right.
And the lead singer from the Mystics, Phil.
Right.
Was absent without leave. He was AWOL.
That's correct.
Hit already.
Right.
It had a hit already with Hushabye.
Right.
And they got this guy named John Traynor.
Right.
To fill in, and he recorded White Cliffs of Dover and the other sides with them.
Right.
After Hushabye.
Right.
But they weren't treating Jay like Phil. I mean, these,
right.
They were like us. They all grew up in the same neighborhood. They
well,
had together.
Their family, you know that I sang with George Galfo and the Mystics, you know, for about a whole bunch of years myself. So, you know, I kind of know the story.
Privy to the story.
Right.
So Kenny and I are up there. We're getting tired of going through all of the extra effort of having a girl lead singer.
Right.
But 99% of every act that was advertised. And we usually had a big common dressing room.
Right.
We'd go to do a show. It was like one huge dressing room.
Right.
We had to hang up a blanket and so she could change, and she had 40 pounds of makeup with
you. Just didn't have the right girl. Right. Some girls like that.
Yeah, well, this girl was, she's my girlfriend, so she was a real toots.
Right.
You know, but she could sing, man. She was a good singer.
I sang with three of them in Harmony Street, and they used to get on stage and say, we have three times of the month in this group, and we take it out on him, and I used to go, oi. I understand.
So you understand, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we loved Jay Traynor's voice.
Right.
He was singing with the Mystics.
Right.
Kenny and I kept looking at each other when we were doing these shows.
Right.
And, you know, well, the Mellow Kings were there.
Right.
Singing Tonight Tonight. And all of these people managed by Gribble.
Well, I spent probably about 4 hours talking to Jimmy Gallagher today. And we talked about you because I haven't spoken to Jimmy in a couple of weeks. And we talked almost 4 hours today. So, you know, that's a tie-in to Jimmy Gribble.
Well, we loved his voice.
Right.
I mean, if there ever was the typical brilliant, beautiful Irish tenor.
Right.
That was Jimmy Gallagher.
Right.
And he was a real great singer.
Oh, yeah, and still is.
Yeah, still got the chops. So anyway, we were up there, and we just looked at each other one day and said, you know, let's see if we can have an all-guys group. You know,
right.
Really be cool to just be guys.
Right, hang out.
So we can hang out.
Right.
We can hang out. You know, and we asked Jay Traynor, and he said, yeah, I'd love it, because he was fed up. He was being treated like a second-class citizen.
Right.
So that, when the minute that went down, I picked up the telephone, and I called my best friend, Howie Kane.
Right.
Who I grew up on the streets of Brooklyn.
Right.
Also. And I don't know what it was about the water in Brooklyn, but everybody in Brooklyn sang.
There were You're right. You had you had so many groups, classics and mystics.
Yeah.
Passions.
You know, the Jive Five. Everybody sang.
That's right. Herkimer Street.
Right. So I called Howie, and he said, yeah, man, I'm in. You know, and that was it. That was what happened. Plain and
wow.
That group became, it was an unnamed group. We didn't have a name. Went up, and we had the Chops to audition for Lieber and Stoller.
Right.
Took Chops to do, because they were the kings of the independent production company.
Absolutely.
It was like Motown before Motown.
Right.
That was Hit City, and that was in the...
And in those days, you know, you could go up there and just say, hey, we got a tune, or a piano vocal, or whatever. I used to go up to Joe Kolsky at Prelude, and whatever. He'd say, yeah, that's very nice, but, you know, see you later. And you could go. Now you have to bring them the whole world.
I had to sneak into the Brill Building. you had to have an appointment. Nobody had appointments. So everybody was lying, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I got an appointment at Chapel Music. And you throw a name at the guy at the elevator.
Right.
And he'd go, he'd look at you, and he'd make a decision. It was like getting into Studio 54.
Right.
And you'd get into the building, and then you'd hit every office in sight.
What happens when he says you, but not you, and half the group has to go in?
Yeah, well, that didn't happen very often.
Right.
We were pretty clean-cut kids.
Right.
Now, they knew that we weren't in there to be rowdy.
Right.
But to break windows, you know,
right.
That's what they were really good. Yeah, we were not, we were Brooklyn guys, and we didn't take care of ourselves.
Right.
But we didn't come in looking rowdy. We looked like students.
It's funny because Jay Siegel said to me, there's only a couple of us that sing Jew-op. I'm one of them.
Right.
And you can go out and find the short list is like right around the corner.
Oh, yeah. That's it. That's funny.
You know.
So anyway, we would get in and we walked in and we got, and that was it. And they wanted to name us Binky Jones and the Americans. But Lieber and Stoller were very tongue-in-cheek guys.
They right.
were the kind of guys that, you know, I mean, guys that wrote Yakety Yak and Charlie Brown.
Right.
And all of those songs, which are very tongue-in-cheek also.
I know.
Poison Ivy,
right.
Ocean Number 9. I mean, you keep going. Every one of those songs is like a vignette, but it's a comedy routine.
Well, it's funny because my interview last week actually was Carl Gardner. He's 82. And Vita was with him and kind of helped him through it. But he was telling me exactly what you're saying about Lieber and Stoller. They just, those guys were a little zany themselves, right?
Oh, they were very, you know, well, what they were white guys that wanted to be black guys.
Okay.
In other words, everything that they did was really surrounding themselves with black artists. One guy, he grew up in the outskirts of Baltimore.
Right.
He'd go to, like, black churches, you know, like Elvis did.
Right, okay.
You know, and he was into black music. Both of those guys were into black music.
Because Gary Katz, I gave him every production I ever did, and he said, what am I supposed to do with white Jewish vocals? And I would say, I don't know. He says, you know, there's a little bit of soul mixed in there, but, you know, it's like, you know, you gotta like, soul it up a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Blacken it up for me.
They were so into soul that we went in an audition.
Right.
I mean, they didn't even think that they didn't like Elvis's record of Hound Dog.
Right. Okay. They wanted the pure R&B version.
No, Big Mama Thornton was the one who recorded it.
Gotcha.
That was the version that they approved of.
Right.
And then Elvis was Pat Boone. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. I hear you.
Yeah. So when we walked in, there was just something about us that as white as we were, there was something about Trainor's voice and the way we hit the harmonies and the pop stuff. There was just something about it that sounded just a little bit funky enough.
Yeah.
That they went for it. You know, they liked it.
Wow.
But they wanted to name us Binky Jones and the Americans.
I never knew that. I can't believe that.
But, yeah, they...
That would have been tough to live down.
Well, you can't trademark the Americans.
I guarantee that I wouldn't have come onto this group to be Binky.
Right.
Or the third Binky.
We were so excited to find that we walked, just not saying anything.
Right.
And all of us went home that night, and we all got on the phone.
Right.
And so all of us agreed, you know what? I can't live my life.
Right.
I can't put my head on this pillow and know that I'm going to be called Binky Jones in the American.
Right.
So we you know, it took a lot to stand up to Lieber and Stoller.
Right.
Because those guys were like, it was like we were in God's office.
Right, they told you.
Yeah.
You didn't tell them.
We're just happy that they gave us the audition. We
right.
Yeah. You know, just the fact that we were standing with the Coasters and the Drifters and Clyde McFadden and Benny King.
Wow.
And the Knighters.
Sure.
We were overwhelmed. We
were
just overwhelmed.
Right.
So, you know, we were ready to go, and then we said, you know what, I can't live with it. We all called up. We said, look. You know what? I understand that you can't trademark the Americans.
Right.
You got to put something in front of it.
Right.
You know, like a la Little Anthony and the Imperial.
Right.
And but they wanted to do something funny.
Right.
So we said, how about, you know, the lead singer's nickname is Jay, and Jay is very unethnic. It's an American.
Yeah, you're right.
It's an American name. There is no other country
right
that has the name J-A-Y.
That's correct.
As a name.
Right.
So they said, okay, we'll go for that.
Right.
We're concerned with the legality of it. So that's how the name became Janie Mary.
Well, you had Jason, but that was too biblical, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's ethnic. Jason could be ethnic.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
That there's no way to turn J-A-Y into anything ethnic other than American.
Right. And, you know, I'll tell you a funny story, because you do it in the act and you say, this is exactly how we did it. And you do Wisdom of a Fool, which is probably the one of the last tunes I would pick for you guys to go in there and do, you know, because, and you do it right on the money. And with my ears, because, you know, I sing this stuff too, and I'm saying, they don't just do it. There were guys in there floating around and bending the notes. And, I mean, you know, you don't just sing it. You really have it arranged, and it's very cool.
Arrangement. It is in a vocal arrangement.
Yes, it is.
Okay. It changes. First one guy moves, then another guy.
I know, and I noticed that, and I said to myself, if they were hep and you sang it that way, they have to have heard that, because everybody that floats at a different time in their spot and still lands on the same note, you know, together inside the chord, it's got to be good stuff.
If you're lucky enough to have someone to love you, then be glad that you have someone to love you, for the lips that were warm can grow cool. Listen to the wisdom of a fool.
Wisdom of
when
a
you
fool.
Take her apart and you do something to it, then you say to yourself, oh, why did I do it? You may find that the world can be cruel. So just listen to the wisdom of a fool. For I had a love just the same as you, and I was too blind to see. But you still have time to say you're sorry. I'm afraid it's too late, for me. So go back to the arms that you know will be waiting. Hold her close in your arms and be glad she is waiting. You'll be happy, believe me, if you only
listen
to the wisdom
of a
fool.
Wisdom of a fool.
Well, the remarks that we used to get was,
right.
I mean, we always had the incredible lead singers.
Right.
Whether it was Jay Traynor.
Right.
Jay Black.
Right.
We call him Davey, you know, David Black.
Right.
But either of those guys, and now this new guy.
Right.
You've got these three incredible voices.
The new guy. What's his name again?
You call him Three.
You call him Three? You know, hey, you know what's really funny? Sorry, Jay. You should put a big three on his back.
So, right?
Like, and he should turn around. You know, it's like you know, like a Yankee uniform. You know, let him turn around, like, have a big three on it.
Oh, I wish I had number three of the Yankees.
Yeah, how about that? Right. No, that's retired. You're not ready to retire.
All right. But the point is that they always said that the Americans
right.
always sounded like five guys singing, not like three or four.
Right.
Even when we had four guys.
Right.
Yeah, because we used to shift parts, and the
backgrounds,
they weren't just block chords.
Right.
There was always shit happening. If you got to listen.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it was mixed down a little more than when I started producing the group.
Right.
Backgrounds flew right up to the top.
Hey, it's funny when you know what you're doing. You know, it makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah, exactly. story. But, you know, at the very beginning, sometimes the backgrounds are a little bit obscured, but they were arrangements. They were vocal arrangements. You know, Lieber and Stoller like these orchestrations.
You know, Jimmy and I were talking about that today. We were saying, you know, the difference between a bunch of guys that get together and they're all good singers, but they have to work out a song for like 3 months until every inflection is right, as opposed to four or five guys who just get together. They say, what song are we doing? They chime off and they sing it. Next song, you know, guys that they can hear the changes, know what's going on. It's a big difference, you know. You know how it is.
Exactly, exactly. You know, like there are guys that can play rhythm guitar, and then there are guys that play lead guitar. And
right.
Have harmony guys, and you've got three guys playing lead or four guys playing lead, it becomes a lot more intricate and a lot more interesting.
Right. Well, you know, I noticed, too, that as I listen more and more, Jane Americans they didn't overpower you on arrangements. And, you know, there was an acoustical quality to it where, you know, it's very funny. And we'll talk about Gary Katz later. He used to say to me, you know, the secret to Steely Dan is the fact that, you know, the rhythm tracks were a click track and a Rhodes, and everything else was an overdub. So you say to yourself, you don't have to clutter your tracks up in order to be cooking.
Less is more.
Yeah, less is more, right.
There you go.
Or they say, like in the studio, you know, if you want more treble, just roll off a little bass, because you want to stay to the midpoint. You don't, because if you add more treble, then all of a sudden you're off the chart, you know.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting, and you're absolutely right. Getting back to Jay Traynor, and the Mystics. You know, it's funny because what a tremendous opportunity for him. I actually ran into him after he had left Jay and the Americans, and he had a tune called Looking Out My Window that he wanted my group to record, and we almost actually recorded it. The commonality was a guy by the name of Gino Moretti, who was with MGM Records. And as a matter of fact, I went to Herrick's, which is in Manhasset, and, you know, Jay was in Mineola for a long time. So I knew him in that respect in those days. But that was after he had left the Americans.
Right.
You know.
Well, things happen for a reason.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Tell me about Terry Phillips.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah.
Well, he got us together to sing. He lived in Bell Harbor in the Ponset.
Right, I know where it is.
I had moved from Brooklyn to Bell Harbor.
Uh-huh.
So we got together with him. He came to us and said, listen, you know, he knew us from singing in the school and, and me and Sidell and all of that stuff.
Right.
And he knew Kenny and he knew me. And he said, listen, he said, I can get you a record deal.
Right.
You know, and he was going to get us up to Lieber and Stoller.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually did get us into Lieber and Stoller, but he only would let us sing songs he wrote.
Uh-huh. In other words, there was a catch to it.
There was a catch to
right.
it, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he took us in there. And Lieber and Stoller said to him, well, you know, we like the guys, but we hate your song, we hate the material. And he stormed out of the place.
Wow.
Dragging us with him because he made the appointment.
Right.
And we said, you know what? The next day, we talked again, and we said, you know what?
Wow.
You're right, this material sucks.
I'm with you.
They're killing us those months.
Right.
Trying to get this stuff perfect because we were perfectionists.
Right.
And the sound, you know, our sound was there.
Right.
But the material just wasn't there. So we went back into Lieber and Stoller's office and waited for that audition.
Wow.
And finally they saw us, and we just sang that a cappella song.
Unbelievable.
They said, you know what? We'll get you material.
Wow. Yeah, that's true, because these, you know, it's funny how many tunes, stacks and stacks of tunes they have. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine is Marv Kalfin. Do you remember him? He used to write, he was on the writing team with Laurie Records for a while. He wrote Just to Be With You for the Passions.
Yeah.
Marvin Kalfin. He's a neighbor of mine and a good friend.
The thing is, I don't know if you ever walked into Lieber and Stoller's office.
No, never had the pleasure.
It was a suite of offices. When you walked in.
Uh-huh. I'm sure it was a lot neater than Joe Franklin's office.
It was beautiful. Beautifully done, you know, paneled walls.
Right.
Glass doors. When you walked in, every inch of wall space was covered.
Yeah.
Either a BMI gold record or a piece of sheet music
wow.
of a song that they wrote
mm.
or a record, and they had wall. I'm telling you, they had hundreds of feet of wall space.
So it was like a museum.
It was like going to the Rock and Roll Museum.
Yeah.
Right? Except that they wrote everything or produced everything.
Unbelievable.
It was endless. The walls went down the corridor, around the bend. It was like stupid that how many inches.
I can imagine.
You walk in and you see that hanging on the wall, and you start to read the names, you know,
right.
of the songs. Hound Dog is the first song you see.
Right.
And then it gets worse from there, you know what I'm saying?
You know,
but talk about being intimidated to be around guys. I mean, these guys were writing and producing stuff.
Right, they've heard it all.
Or done it all, heard it all, written it all, you know, and they were the benchmark. And we just sat there and listened.
Yeah.
Whatever they said, you jump through this, we jump through this.
Yep, no, I can imagine.
It took a lot of years for us to get up the gumption to say, hey, you know what,
yeah.
we want to do it this way.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine you just raised your hand every time. May I?
Absolutely.
May I sing this, please?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, sit down, guys. All right. Now you guys can come in this part.
Wow.
It was very frustrating.
That's amazing. And you know, here are the guys. Of course, they didn't start out as Kane, Sanders, Dean, and Vance. But, you know, it's funny because people say to me, oh, Mike Miller, you know, what's your real name? And I say, no, it's Miller. You know, that's the way it is. And it's funny about names, like in the industry, you're like, you know, whose name is who and whose name is what. But people get to remember you by a certain name, and that's it. It sticks, you know.
Well, we started with our real names.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, Sandy.
Which, by the way, were great names to begin with.
Here's the problem.
Yep.
The problem was, don't fall asleep on me, three.
There we go.
Anyway,
you know, to be honest, actually, I've heard this story, and this actually
I know.
Is a very funny story.
But, Jay, don't go away, because I got a lot of stuff to ask you, man.
Cut it out with our real names.
Uh-huh.
Now, you know my real name. It's kind of unusual.
And yes, I do.
And when we started singing in 1960,
right.
there was no such thing as an unlisted number.
Right.
And we lived at home with our parents.
Right, okay.
So at 3 o'clock in the morning, some giggling girl, wake my parents, look up the phone number in the phone book.
Isn't that funny?
Brooklyn.
Wow.
Which was sitting there like a, you know, like in boldface capital letters.
Right. And in those days, it was like Talmadge 3, Sycamore 2, you know.
Yeah. Buckminster 4.
Right.
But they just look up the number and call. And we were getting a ton of these giggling fans.
Unbelievable.
Waking my mother up, and my father was getting furious.
Yeah, but you know what? Last week you had giggling fans in the audience.
Yeah.
You did.
Nice and out. At least I wish they were waking up my mother. Yeah.
I used to look out off the stage sometimes and call it the oil painting because nothing was moving. I would say, is that an oil painting? Oh, yeah, no. Somebody, you know, somebody like raise your hand so I could see some movement out there. Go ahead.
My father was going to kill me, and my father was bigger than me.
Uh-huh.
So I said, okay, here's what we can do. We couldn't change our phone number because you didn't do that in those days.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Well, we changed our names. We all right. got stage names
uh-huh.
so that when the next records came out,
uh-huh.
it was Dean, Sanders, Kane,
right.
and Vance.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So that the parents weren't being disturbed.
Right.
You know, then when we got older and we reached this point, we don't care which name you use because it's okay.
Just invite us and let us sing and pay us and let us go home and you could call me whatever you want.
Having too good a time.
Hey, you, the Americans, get over here. Okay.
So we're having a really good time.
It's funny with names because
this new guy, you know, somebody joining a group, like when Trainer joined the Mystics,
right,
doesn't necessarily mean that you become a part of a group. In the entertainment business, whether it's a film or a Broadway show or
right.
a television show, people get very close.
Oh yeah.
And either they really get along or they really don't get along.
Well, hitting really good harmony and bonding, like with four guys and being on a road and hanging out, whatever. It's, you know, when you're on stage, that's like a spiritual, emotional experience, and you make bonds, you know.
So with them just being on stage and executing.
Right.
Part of the traveling and being together.
Oh, yeah.
Breaking bread and liking each other. And
absolutely.
Rooms and, God knows what else, you know?
And you learn to tolerate, just like you learn in a family. You know, you learn to tolerate each other, and you get to know each other's moves and each other's moods, and, you know, I mean, it's...
When you're young, you have a lot less tolerance than when you're older.
Right. No, I hear you.
Which is why groups break up so much. You know, between the wives and the intolerance and the egos. You know, once you get past 50... It's a different thing, you know, like you have a different attitude.
Well, I know what you mean. And it's funny with names because, you know, I sang with a guy years ago. His name was actually Harvey Lipschitz. And he went to my school, and for years everybody kidded him about his name. So he didn't know what to do. He got to be about 28 years old, and he actually decided he was going to change his name. So he went to the judge. And he says, I want to change my name. The judge says, what do you want to change it to?
He says,
Ralph Lipschitz. I can't stand the name Harvey.
I know. I knew I heard that joke.
I know. Rimshot.
I was waiting for it.
I know.
Anyway.
And by the way, you know that we're missing American Idol.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, but that's all right.
I know. It's all right.
I'll call you later, tell you later.
My wife will give me an update.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, wait a minute. But she might have watched Dancing with the Stars unless she TiVo'd the others. So.
She TiVo'd the others.
You know.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, anyway, that's the deal with the names and the stage names.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was the real reason. My parents were getting aroused in the middle of the night.
Uh-huh.
You know.
And, no. Which was a good thing because there wouldn't be a Sandy, you know.
True.
You know, now, how did Gary Katz come into the picture? Because you know that I'm related to him. He was married to my cousin Adrian.
Gary lived in Brooklyn. Howie and me were from the same neighborhood as Gary.
Right.
So we knew Gary from the streets.
Uh huh.
You know, I mean, we knew Gary's father, and we knew the haberdashery.
Right.
I mean, you know, we know the whole deal.
Uh-huh.
And Gary was like, you know, he loved the music. He just loved the music.
Uh-huh.
And Gary really came into the picture. Gary is a guy who hates everything.
Right.
I mean, you know, no singer is really any good. The last good singer was Rudy Lewis from the Drifters.
Oh, yeah. You know something? Yeah, I hear you.
You know, Benny, Rudy.
Right.
You know, these guys are the guys that he said, those guys.
The lineage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He was into that kind of music.
Right.
And when I'll tell you a funny story. He came to the first show that David Black did with us.
Right.
After Jay Traynor. He loved Jay's voice. Everybody liked Traynor's voice.
Right.
When he came to, I think it was the Camelot.
Right.
The first place we played.
Hmm.
Black got up on stage, did the show, he got through it, you know.
Right.
He was very nervous.
Yeah, I heard that at the beginning. I mean, you know, he kind of grew out of that nervousness, didn't he? But I heard he was very nervous at the beginning.
He threw up as they were announcing us, he puked in the bathroom.
All right.
Waiting to go on.
Wow.
How nervous he was. Howie and I had to lead him onto the stage.
Wow.
While Kenny was wiping his boots off.
Wow.
Anyway, but he got through the show.
Wait, I want to stop you for 1 second. Jay, I saw you before the show, and you were calm as could be. So, you know, there's a big difference right there.
He's a very confident
person. I don't always show if I'm nervous, because what I do is I put myself in a zone right before I walk on the stage. Plus, I tell you what, I take full advantage of the fact, again, that I'm with these three guys. And it's fun to walk on stage as part of that whole group.
Well, you know how you could be thinking or doing anything before you go on, and all of a sudden, you know, when they call, and Jay and the Americans, and then you turn that switch and you become that person all of a sudden. You couldn't do that all day long. You know, you'd be nuts.
Oh. That would be draining.
Right, you know.
The comment,
Pax
was in the audience when we did the show.
Uh-huh.
And the audience went wild. Katz comes over to me, Gary comes over to me.
Right.
I hate this guy. The other guy was much better.
Oh.
He loved Traynor's voice.
Right. Smooth.
Like Jay Black's voice.
Right.
You know what? It's like chocolate and vanilla.
No, I hear you.
And some people really don't like that.
Right.
You know? What I like about this guy is he's got a little of both.
Well, you know, if somebody asked me the difference, I would say, you know, Jay Traynor's voice is very smooth and silky, and David's voice has a little bit of a whine in it, you know, a little bit of a cry in it, a little bit of a, like Deanne always said that he actually got the whine in his voice from listening to Vito Pacone. Well, you know, maybe David Blatt did the same thing. I don't know. But there is a distinct difference.
David Blatt liked the guy in the Hilltoppers.
Oh, okay. I hear you.
That was his guy. Him and Mario Lanza.
Well, we all listened to Mario Lanza when we were a kid because our fathers used to play that stuff.
Right.
That's what they played. I remember my father used to play the Mario Lanza, record, and then the next one that would drop down was the Harry Belafonte record.
That's funny.
You remember. I mean, that's what there were certain records that were in everybody's like little cachet, and you know, boom, okay, and they really didn't segue it too well. It was whatever they felt like throwing on there.
Oh, in my house, I had an older sister, uh-huh. And she was playing Bessie Smith.
Oh, okay.
She was playing Mel Torme.
Uh huh.
She was the Bobby Soxer with Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
And there was a lot of blues going on in my house.
Uh huh.
But she did play the Four Freshmen, and she did, you know, a lot of that stuff. Was going on, big bands. I mean, I heard a lot of different music.
Well, I was the only 5-year-old whose mother, you know, used to throw a transistor radio, I think, in the crib to keep me quiet. And I used to find, like, Symphony Sid and Jaco and, you know, and I was, yeah. So by the time I was 9, I knew the words to all the Harp Tones tunes and whatever, and I didn't know how I knew it. You know?
Meet the Jesters was my favorite album.
How do I know this? You know? I shouldn't know this. How do I know this? But I knew it.
Right.
You know.
Well, I compare Jay Traynor to like a Mel Torme guy.
Right.
You know, smooth as silk.
Right.
Perfect control.
Well, he did a lot of big band up in Albany for a while, didn't he?
Yeah, he did Sinatra. He did a lot of Sinatra stuff.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, he's into it, but that's really his style. That is his style.
Yeah, the Come Fly With Me stuff, you know. Right.
The other Jay was like, break glass with your voice.
Right.
You know, break the crystal in the china cabinet.
Yeah.
That's where he's coming from.
Break the crystal, break your heart, break your microphone.
Yeah, break your wrist.
Right. It's funny, you know, because I read about Kenny. They said, well, Kenny was the one that turned his heel and went back into the office and said, you know, we need to make this deal and whatever.
I remember what happened was he spoke to his mom.
Oh, okay. Mrs. Rosenberg.
Is Ethel Rosenberg.
I know. I met her at the Broward Center a couple of years ago.
Ethel said to him, you go back and you tell those guys. He told you you were going to have a deal. And Kenny actually marched back in, and because of him, gave us that next shot.
Well, here's my thinking on that. I said, you know, Kenny on stage is about 5'11", and when he puts the hat on, he's 6'1". But when he stands up tall and takes the hat off, he's 6'7". So probably he didn't have the hat, and probably he walked in there and stood up tall, and they said, uh-oh, we better listen to this guy.
Kenny is basically short.
I know that.
Oh. He's really basically shy.
I know.
And for him to do that, he needed his mom to rev him up.
Wow.
And his mom revved him up. Ethel was the one that said, you don't, but they like you and they want you to let this stand in your... You go back and tell them they made a deal, they were going to sign you.
Isn't that funny?
You know, don't let them, you know, and he walked back in after they said yes, they changed their minds again. I mean, these guys, they were so busy with so many other things that were more important than us. And we were a white act that they really weren't looking to have a white act.
I hear you. Yeah, because, I know how much they loved the Drifters, you know.
Oh, the Drifters. Wait a minute. They started with the Robins. I mean, they...
Right.
They made a ton of money off of
Smokey Elvis. Joe's Cafe.
Yeah. But they made it. They went from the Robins to became the Coasters and the Drifters. And I mean, they wrote all of this great bluesy stuff.
Right.
You know, so for us to walk in, we were like kids for college kids, for Christ's sake.
Right.
You know, we could have been, as far as they were concerned, we were the Kingston Trio.
So, you know, like the first release was Tonight, right? The West Side Story tune?
Right. That was the first thing they took us in the studio to do.
Right.
3-piece orchestra.
You know, well, and not exactly a Drifters tune, but then again, you know...
I thought it was from West Side Story.
Broadway show tunes are always
there.
Right. You know, And then, you know, we had this talk, you know, in the dressing room. You know, I asked you about the tune Dawning, and you said, you know, that's not a tune that, you know, we don't do the tune. And then I realized that Dawning was actually supposed to be the A side, and She Cried was the B side.
Right.
Right. Well, Dawning is a tune based on Peer Gynt's Suite.
Yeah.
A classical piece.
Oh, right. Okay. I got you. Okay. Now I think I understand.
Okay. And we liked doing it at the time. We were kids and we were bang, bang, bang.
Right.
You know, and it was fun and it was a cute song. Melody was very familiar to people because it was a classical piece of music.
Right.
But it wasn't nearly as good as She Cried.
Okay, so we go through the David Blatt and the Jay Black situation. Everybody knows that there were a bunch of tunes. I guess, as I understand it, Marty and David had some things that they were doing actually, before David got into the Americans. I never knew that.
Marty and David were a group called the Two Chaps.
Yeah, they live next
and
door.
And they were also signed by Ivy Records.
Right.
Which was the same record company that signed the Harbolites.
Okay.
So Kenny and I, and Marty and Jay,
right,
were all signed to this little Ivy Records at the same time. We never knew each other.
Right.
I mean, we knew Marty. Marty played guitar for every group that walked in the door.
Right. Now let me, Jay. You know, when you were younger and you were listening to Jay and the Americans, what prompted you to go out and do like a Jay and the Americans tribute type thing? Was it because you thought your voice was similar to what they were doing, or was it just something that you heard and you liked at that point?
Well, keep in mind I am younger than these guys, and I was growing up with this music. And I remember in '65, I mean, I was like, 11? But I remember that's when you're first getting into music as a kid, probably 10, 11 years old.
Right.
And I heard Cara Mia for the first time, and I thought, whoa, this is really cool.
Right.
And I pretty much had decided I love big voices. I mean, Roy Orbison, Elvis, Gary Puckett, these type of big voices I loved. And, again, same thing with Jay Black. It was a big voice. And as I began singing during college, which was actually when I was a theater major,
right.
I realized that I could actually do some of the big voices if
right.
I, you know, really worked at it.
Right.
And after performing with my other group for a number of years, we started doing all these different songs from these big voices.
What did the group start off doing, and what kind of stuff were you doing? Just
well, the
classic rock and.
When I first started, it was doing like doo-wop-y stuff.
And oh, okay.
60s, but the thing was, we always did, you know, we actually did She Cried.
Wow.
When I was early on in my group, and then after about 10 years, you know, as we got like into the 1980s,
yeah.
I started doing Cara Mia, I started doing This Magic Moment, I started doing Only in America.
Wow. But, you know, She Cried is not really an easy tune to do, you know, because it's all open, you know, I mean, it's all vowels. So to sing it straight out, it really is a bigger song to sing than it sounds sometimes.
It is. Well, like yeah. I said, I just evolved from that to, you know, all the really big voice stuff.
Right.
And at the time that Sandy had got the name and they were looking for a J.
Right.
That's, you know, when we were literally doing like six J in the American songs.
Right.
And, I mean, we were doing Only in America. We were doing She Cried at the time.
Right.
We were doing Cara Mia, This Magic Moment,
that's
Come
amazing.
A Little Closer, and Walk
yeah.
in the Rain.
Wow. That's
so, you know, these were second nature songs for me because we've been doing them in the original keys all
right.
that time.
Were you doing Hushabye?
We did Hushabye, but we were doing more of like the Mystics version of
uh-huh.
Hushabye.
Uh-huh.
But of course, coming into this group, it was very easy to adapt to our version of Hushabye, which I think is beautiful.
Right. Well, you know, having sung with George for so many years, I mean, I probably sang Hushabye, you know, 1,001 times and everything, but the other version is a little bit different. I mean, your version is a little bit different, and the Beach Boys version is still a little bit different. But your version is very distinctly Jay and the Americans.
Oh,
that's the point. You know, we take songs, no matter what the song, whether they were hits before, like we did with Walking in the Rain.
Right.
Whether it was a hit by the Drifters, like This Magic Moment.
Right.
And we treat it like it's never been recorded before.
Well, the way the horns were treated in This Magic Moment and the way you approached the song, I mean, there was an awful lot of stuff going on in that song, because we actually did it with our Mystic group. We did your version of it, believe it or not. And it's quite intricate with it's got a lot of stops and a lot of little breaks and a lot of things where you go from unison to harmony and things like that, which are different than just a straight ahead version.
This magic moment, so different and so new, was like any other, until I kissed you, and then it happened. It took me by surprise, I knew that you felt it too, by the look in your eyes, sweeter than wine.
Oh, yeah, of course.
The effect that we spoke to the horn players.
Right.
And the benchmark remark was, we want it to sound like the Salvation Army Band.
Uh-huh. Ba-ba-da, ba-ba-da-ba-da. I got you. Now I got it.
And that's what it sounds like.
Did people throw pennies and
One of the most famous horn solos
right.
in rock and roll.
Yeah.
And it does sound like a Salvation Army band.
That's amazing. And, you know, it's something that I never knew. And that's why we have interviews like this, so people can say, yeah. Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
it's true.
Yeah.
It's great stuff, you know. And you know, what's funny, it must be like going to Disneyland musically, Jay, you know, to say, well, gee, I've always sung their music. And here I am, I'm now such an integral part of the group with guys that are just, you know, if I might say, Sandy, you know, doo-wop and pop, American pop royalty, which is exactly what you are. So it must be a thrill for you. It has to be.
Oh, it is. It's an incredible thing. But I think part of the reason for that is, number one, having actually experienced these songs
Right.
Now, hearing those actual voices behind me.
Right.
It's an amazing thing. I mean, I still remember the first rehearsal I had with these guys in the studio.
Right.
And I'm sitting there, and I call my wife from the studio. I said, I'm singing with Jay and the Americans. It's like, this is incredible.
And what did she say? Yeah, right.
Oh, she knew. Yeah. You know, she knew what was going on. She was a big part of what was going on. And, you know, like I said, she was just as blown away as I was because it was it's an incredible feeling.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I was singing with Harmony Street, and that was three girls and two guys, believe it or not, we were the entertainment for Bill and Hillary Clinton in 98 at their Christmas party. And, you know, when I first realized that we were going to do that, and that's a long story in itself. And I told my wife at that time, who I was going through a divorce with, I said, we're going to be singing at the White House. She said, yeah, right. Come on. Well, come on. Yeah, right. So, you know, all of a sudden you have to pinch yourself with things like that. And you have to say, am I really doing this? And I stood right next to you before you went on stage at Nova University, in Florida. And you had stars in your eyes. But boy, were you well received.
Well, you know, I think again, you know, I enjoy the interaction with some of the other groups as well as, you know, we're getting on stage to perform with these guys. It's amazing to hear all these other groups that sound so incredible. That night at Nova, of course, we're singing with the Crests, and we had the Crystals there. Dee Dee and the Crystals were great, and the Times were wonderful. They sounded
Absolutely.
I enjoyed them very much.
Yeah, everybody was great that night.
Oh, and the Coasters, you know, put on a wonderful show themselves, and I think that's part of it. It's not so much necessarily the performance itself, but the whole performance.
Oh, the camaraderie and you know, because Barry puts on a great show, and you know, both shows were really great shows, and they were the audiences were great, and they were very appreciative. I was appreciative of the fact that JT Carter asked me to sing with him for those two shows, you know, especially being it timely that you know, we lost such a great as Johnny Maestro, and you know, we all knew him and whatever, and what a loss that was. I mean, the ripple effects of that will be, you know, will be for a long, long time, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, again, I got to meet Maestro a couple of times.
Right.
We worked with him.
Right.
And you know, I always enjoyed his singing, you know, just right off of anything. And again, it was a wonderful experience to meet a guy like that.
Absolutely.
Like, the guy really is a, you know, again, he's rock and roll royalty too.
And a sweet guy, you know, he's a sweet guy. A lot of people think that he was very standoffish, but he wasn't. He was just very shy himself.
Right.
He's not, you know, he doesn't run down the hall and say, hey, how you doing? Like Jane the Americans would do, you know, grab you and tackle you and throw you down and lick your face. But Johnny Maestro was the type of guy that just, you know, he'd say, hey, how are you? You know, that was it. That was the way he hugged you, you know.
Yeah. No, he was, like I said, I only met the man a couple of times, but I was blown away by his talent as well. Here's a guy who was, you know, 70 years old, and you would have thought he just, you know, you would have thought it was 50 years ago when you heard him.
Right. And you know, and I kept, every time I would see him, I would say to him, are you getting shorter? You know, what's going on? But you know what happens. You know, somebody told me once, no matter where you're born, no matter what ethnicity you are, by the time you reach 90, all 90-year-old men start shrinking and speaking Jewish. So, you know, that's the way it is, you know.
Well, that's what I've got to look forward to, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, you're keeping all these guys young. Well, I want to tell you something. The group on stage has so much energy and is, I mean, you sit there. I'll tell you a story is that, you know, there were a lot of people from other groups in that audience, you know, that just came down who weren't working and whatever. Not to go through all the names, there were a bunch of them, maybe 20 of them in that audience. And
really?
I spoke to a few of them, and they were saying to me, oh, my God. I mean, it was so much a step above everything else, you know, that they've heard. And wow, what a sound. And, you know, I mean, it was like the entire group had never left. You know, it was right there, right down to the, you know, Marty's guitar, you know, that acoustical sound and whatever. It was all right there. I mean, it's just amazing. So I realize how much work you guys have put into it, and how you must critique everything that you do in order to fine tune it to that point where people would think that you had never missed a day, let alone a few years.
Well, the best remark that we get two main remarks from the audience.
Uh-huh.
One is they love the stories.
Right.
They get a big kick out of the stories.
Oh, absolutely. Because they feel like, you know, they want to know. They want to know how you got there, what's going on, you know.
The remark we get is that you guys sound so young. How do you do that?
Yeah, no. And the body language on stage is young, too. You know what I'm saying?
But just the fact that vocally, you know, listen, we've seen a lot of the acts from our era.
And let's be honest, some of the guys just don't, you know, they're there, but it's not what it was. I hear you.
What it was. It's a shadow of what it was.
Yep.
And it's because, you know, people age differently.
No, I know.
Why? But thank God, for some reason, people seem to tell us, even my wife says to me, you sound the same, you guys sound the same as you sounded when you were playing Madison Square Garden in New York, you know, 45 years ago.
But there's a reason for that.
Sound the same.
And I think I know the reason. The reason is that you have to be so thrilled and so elated and so just.
But that doesn't have anything to do with your voice.
Yeah, but the adrenaline and the. No, you're right. You're right. Because, you know, probably the first night you get together to start rehearsing, you know, it was like, okay, you know, I got to do this for a week before that muscle wakes up and says, okay, this is where we are again.
Well, we call ourselves the Rip Van Winkle of rock and roll. Because we were asleep for 40 years, you know what I'm saying?
You ever see the movie with Mel Brooks where he plays all these different characters, you know, from mythology and whatever?
Yeah,
he does Rip Van Winkle, and he's under the thing, and he yawns and goes, oh, and he's getting up, and the townspeople run over, and they say, Rip Van Winkle, you've been asleep for 40 years. You know, oh, my goodness, you know, what are you going to do with your life now that you're awake? He says, I don't know, I'm a little tired. I think I'll take a nap. You can't make that stuff up.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
So, but you know, when it's fresh for us and the audience sees, I mean, we're still excited about performing.
Well, you know what's really funny? I mean,
still are, and some of the acts aren't.
When you talk about the universe, and I believe in the universe, and I believe that you could send something out to the universe and watch it come back. I'm just one of those guys. I'm a true Pisces. But you know what's funny is you say to yourselves, well, you look at how all of you got that first contract, and you look at the history, and you look at what you've gone through, and you say, Jane and the Americans, they are Americana. And and the song, Only in America, you say, well, only in America could this happen. Only in America could you have gone away from it. And as you say, you know, everyone in the group has been successful in their own right, even when they weren't doing Jane and the Americans, which is a classic story because you know how it is sometimes. Groups break up, and sometimes there were guys that can't handle not being on stage anymore, and they get depressed, or they go here, or they go there, or they lose their money. But here are a bunch of guys that were successful in their own right, even when they weren't stars.
True.
You know, which is a great thing. So it comes back together. And it really is a true American story.
Only in America can a guy from anywhere go to sleep a pauper and wake up a millionaire. Only in America can a kid without a cent girl like you fall for a poor boy like me. Only in America can a kid who's pushing cars take a giant step and reach right up and touch the stars. Only in America would a dream like this come true. Start with nothing and end up with you.
Paulette and I, you know, we came home and we said, you know, this is a movie. I have seen them make movies about much lesser heart throbbing stories. You know, this is a movie and probably needs to be a movie.
Yeah. Well, we're actually working on stuff.
I'm just saying it because it's a thought that I had, and probably in the back of my head, I think to myself, well, if they're not working on something like that, then something's wrong, because it should be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting story.
Oh, absolutely.
Buddy Hope.
You know? And you know, I'll tell you something. It was really a thrill getting to see Clay Cole again and working with Clay Cole after all of those years, because he kind of disappeared too.
Yeah.
And
hold on, who's this? Just calling my cell phone.
All right, go ahead.
I'll hang up on him. Yeah. Oh, hang on.
It's Clay Cole.
Hi, this is Clay Cole. You're on the Harmony Street Show with my good friend Mike Miller.
Oh, no. It's Jay's hairdresser.
It's Jay's hairdresser?
Oh,
well, you know, Johnny, the Brooklyn Bridge did give credits on two albums to two people. One was Jerry Bragan from Queens, the vocal coach who worked with Johnny for a couple of years. And the other one was Cy Sperling.
Wow.
From Hair Club for Men. He on the back. And special thanks to Cy Sperling and special thanks to Jerry Bragan, our vocal coach. True story.
That's funny.
That's really, really funny. So, you know, the success all the way through for everybody. And, you know, it's just a wonderful thing. So let's talk a little bit about how and why everybody decided to come back and say, you know what, let's rev this baby up again and let's get out and be the Americans again. Everybody in the business, I mean, you know, you have to know that everybody in the business, the normal, you know, everyday people didn't know, but the people in the business knew that Jay Black was having a little bit of trouble with what was going on, and you know, he kind of, you know, his antics got him into a little bit of trouble, and so and that he wasn't going to be able to use the name, and so, you know, why don't you take it from there, Sandy, and just tell me, you know, like how that all came about, that the group came back together?
Sure. It's easy. I get a call one day. Somebody says to me, listen, Jay Black is going bankrupt, and because he owes the government a ton of money.
Right.
Tax money. A ton, not a little.
Right.
And he hasn't been paying his taxes. He's been gambling.
Right.
He lost all the money. And they're going to take away, in his bankruptcy, they're taking away the name. And they're going to auction off the name Jay and the Americans.
Right.
And I said, oh, my God, because I pictured immediately, you know, three phony Jay and the Americans groups out
there. Yeah, as look, there were some 15-year-old Shangri-Las walking around, too.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
So, you know, the Coasters and the Drifters and
right.
the Shangri-Las. And
right.
I mean, every group has at least two or three
right.
versions of themselves.
Right.
And they're all in their 20s.
I know.
And I said, you know what? That would really destroy my head.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you know, my legacy should not be that.
Right.
So I called my son, who's a pretty successful guy.
Right.
To ask his business advice. And he said, listen, if it's an auction, let's see how much it's going to cost. Let's
right.
And make a bid.
Right.
And we'll protect the name. Because there are guys out there that would buy that name in a heartbeat and put together four guys in a tuxedos, four white guys in tuxedos, and send them out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, not necessarily tuxedos.
Well, no, but you know what I'm saying—a phony put together.
I'll tell you what I would have done. I would have had like a charity function down in Southern Florida. Oh, let's not go there.
Yes. Yeah.
So. The intent, my son Todd said to me, you know what, it's my legacy too, because he grew up
right.
backstage.
Right.
You know? And he said that I would feel terrible if they were putting phony people out there.
Right.
Presenting themselves as you. He said, let's see if we can buy the name. So we put in, you had to put up money just to be allowed into the auction.
I see.
Okay, you had to write a check immediately
right.
just to be considered for the auction.
Wow.
Part of the terms of the auction were, if you would buy the name, You have to be able to represent the music faithfully and accurately.
Right.
Which anybody could do if they really put their mind to it. You know,
right.
In the music business.
Right.
So we put in our first offer, and then the auction came around.
Right.
And at the auction, there was I had heard through the grapevine that somebody had bid the same or more than I had bid.
Right.
And I figured, well, it's either, you know, either Jay Black. Kay finally came up with some money.
Right.
Because he was broke.
Right.
Or his girlfriend came up with it.
I know. Well, the rumor was that she was going to come up and pay it off, but I guess that never happened.
Yeah, right.
Right.
No.
Whatever.
No. And, you know, his attitude was nobody could sing these songs but me.
Uh-huh.
So I don't even think he made a serious attempt at buying it.
Never say never. I learned that.
Yeah. You know, so then there was this other guy who put in this bid, and I go to the auction, and I'm looking for this other guy, and there's no other guy there. I got the big bid, and I won the name.
Wow.
What happened to the other guy? And they said, well, he put in a bid. He matched you. Actually, he beat you by a few grand.
Wow.
And he withdrew his bid. I said, why did he withdraw his bid? And they said, well, there's a letter here from him. And I picked up the letter, and it said that because he's from Chicago and the Truth in Music law.
Oh, yeah.
And Illinois was the first state to pass it.
Right. So you had to not only have the trademark, but you had to be an original member.
Correct.
Right.
At least have one original member.
Right.
Which he did not have. So I said, wow. I said, you know what? I think I should find out what this guy's deal was. If he
wow.
was ready to spend six figures.
Wow.
Either he's just a rich guy who can't sing a lick, like he's a bad American Idol audition,
uh-huh.
or he's really a good singer. I didn't think it could be anywhere in the middle.
Right.
You know, either a fat wallet with no talent, or
right.
be good.
Right.
So I call the number, and I say, you know, hey, my name is Sandy, and he goes, Sandy Yaguda from Jay and the America. It's an honor to talk to you. Now, I'm from Brooklyn. I figure if that's a guy saying that to me,
right.
I'm going to slap him because he's being a wise guy.
Right.
But it wasn't being a wise guy.
Right.
He was really legitimately impressed. And,
right.
and you know what? I knew you would wind up. I'm glad that you wind up with the name
uh-huh.
because if anybody deserves it, you do.
Right.
And I said, well, listen. I said, do you perform? Do you sing or anything? He said, yeah. I said, you sing in Chicago? He said, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I said, are you singing this weekend? He said, yeah.
Right.
I said, is it okay if I fly out with Howie, one of the other Americans?
Right.
To see you? And he said, sure, I'll pick you up at the airport.
Uh-huh.
So we fly out.
And meanwhile, Jay, your heart was beating fast and saying,
well, the funny thing
this
is,
can't be real.
The other guys, the other Americans said, you're never going to get the name. They didn't think I'd win the bid.
Really?
No, Marty and Howie and Jay Trent, nobody thought, Kenny Vance, nobody thought I was going to wind up with the name.
You mean you thought that because it's such a big name, there'd be a whole bunch of guys there slamming money down and whatever, and we know who a lot of those people are.
You know,
right, so, you know.
And David Black being one of them.
Right.
To be honest.
Right.
You know.
I'm surprised he didn't go for it. I'm sure somebody would have backed him, you know.
Well, here's the strangest part of all.
You know,
in the bankruptcy, not only did he not have Jay and the Americans,
right?
He can't perform as Jay Black and the Americans.
I know.
And I could have bought the name Jay Black as well.
Wow.
But his name, he never changed it legally.
Right, yeah, okay.
His name is David Black.
Right.
But I didn't want to be, I felt that would have been bad karma.
Yeah.
I felt he's been out there for 30 years working.
Right.
True, under the false pretenses of Jay Black and the Americans.
Right.
There were no Americans out there.
Right.
But he did have his audience, and he did perform for 30 years.
Right.
And he was entitled to earn a living, so I didn't even offer for the name Jay Black.
Well, he has his little cult following, you know, that'll follow him anywhere. I mean, you know, he does.
Okay, yeah, he's you know. Had a bunch of people who love him and everything.
Right.
So, I mean, he's been out there long enough.
Right.
And he's entitled to it. I mean, he sang all those hits with us.
That's right. And he's insulted every one of them at one point along the line, and they still come. So,
right. You know. So, but the bottom line is I felt it would have been really bad karma to buy the name out from under him.
I agree.
I would have made him pay me to use the name.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, you know, that would really be seedy.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. But we didn't know.
You could have had him wash, you know, wash my Escalade, please.
And nothing could have happened with it.
Right.
Just bad with it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But we fly out, me and Howie fly out to see this guy sing.
Right.
And I got to tell you, man, like, he sang those five songs, you know, Only in America,
right.
A Little Bit Closer,
right.
This Magic Moment.
Right.
And then all of a sudden he said, okay, you know, we're going to do one more song and then we're going to take a break.
Uh-huh.
And he sang Caramia and it was like the place erupted.
Wow.
I mean, he did a great job. And this was a real wild-ass biker bar kind of rock and roll joint.
Uh-huh.
They went nuts, just the way they used to go nuts when we used to do it with David Blatt.
Part of me. Must we say goodbye each time we part? My heart wants to die. Darling, hear my prayer. Thought of me a fan.
They go nuts if you nail it. If you don't nail it, they go, eh.
Right.
You know, you got to nail it.
So I looked at Howie, and Howie looked at me, and I said, you know what? I can make this guy into J number three. I mean, he's uh-huh. chops. Uh-huh. I can do this.
Uh-huh.
He says, I absolutely agree.
Uh-huh.
Now, his wife is sitting across the table from me while I'm saying this.
Wow.
And I turn around. Her name is Lonnie, very sweet girl.
Uh-huh.
And I say, Lonnie, if I offer your husband this job...
Yes, I met her at the St. Petersburg show.
You want
yes.
for this. No, you got to understand something, you know?
Right.
He's in Chicago. They're in Chicago.
Right.
They got their life.
Right.
This is a whole new thing. We're in New York.
Yep.
You know, Chicago is not exactly the heartthrob of the rock and roll industry.
No, but you got your State Street there, and they're dog friendly.
Yeah. So it's like East Coast, West Coast.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's a commitment, and she said, you know what? This has been his dream his whole life.
Wow.
He'd be in the major leagues.
Wow.
I would only want him to be happy.
Wow.
So I'm on board.
Wow.
So then I turned around to Jay and say, Jay, could you you interested in this? And his name is Jay. That's the weirdest.
Yeah. That you couldn't make this up.
Yeah. So we kind of felt that this was like God's plan, not ours.
Yeah, I would agree.
You know, we didn't plan this at all.
I would agree that it's God's plan.
It evolved by itself.
Yep.
The fact that it got good. We all swore that when he came on board, we were going to rehearse.
Right.
And unless it was great, not just okay, if it wasn't great, we were going to can it.
Right. And then what? You mean like go out and look for another Jay or just say...
And if it wasn't, if we couldn't, you know, we didn't know how good we were going to. We hadn't sung together in 40 years.
I hear you. No, I hear you.
You know, it's like, you know, yeah, you know how to ride a bike again. You don't fall down. But
right.
It doesn't mean that you're a cyclist, you know?
Right. If you're running marathons, you can't walk around the block once in a while and then want to run a 26-mile marathon. You got to prepare for it. It's true.
Right. So we didn't know what we were going to be, and we didn't know what he was going to be, and we didn't know how it was going to blend up.
Right.
We didn't know how it was going to work. But we knew that we were either going to be great or we weren't going to do it.
Right.
We all made that commitment. Otherwise, it wasn't worth the effort.
Uh-huh.
So we put in a lot of time. We put in 6 months before we ever did even an inkling of a show.
Right.
And we got it right.
Well, you know, it's funny, too, because just drawing an analogy, you remember when Diana Ross came back and she had that tour with the new Supremes and there was all that controversy over whether Mary was going to be in the group or whatever, and they went out and they did that TV special and they were so unrehearsed that on TV they weren't tight, they weren't together. And what happened was I think the tour started at the Hartford Civic Center and it was only about a third. It was about a third full. I mean, it was like they didn't sell any tickets, and they canceled the tour, and they hurt themselves by going out too quickly.
Yep.
You know, you can do that because people, you say Jay and the Americans, people expect, hey, I'm here to see Jay and the Americans. You better give me Jay and the Americans.
You better be good.
You know, and what I found was that you gave them Jay and the Americans and more. It's like, you know, Jay, we had a talk in the back there, and we said, you know, somebody came up to you and said something about which Jay or who's the real Jay or whatever. I think it's the new and improved Jay.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah. So youthful, so vibrant. So, and I'll tell you what I heard. I heard, you know, when you sang Karamia, you didn't try to, like, oversing it. You didn't try to power it out. You gave it exactly what it needed. It was, you did, you know, if you undersing it, it's no good. If you oversing it, and you try to pin everybody to the wall like some people think they have to do when they sing it, then that's not it. When you got up into the falls, it sweetened out and it was right in the mix of the harmony rather than blowing everybody away. And, you know, people who knew what they were listening to said, you know what? You own it now. I'm telling you.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, but
like I said, it's fun to be able to do a song that you always liked.
Yeah.
Believe me, it's you know, it's big shoes to fill as I learned early on. But at the same time, I get to be me. I just try to be me on this whole thing, and I think that's a lot of what's helped me. I'm not trying to be somebody else. I'm just trying.
I always told them when we started doing this. Listen, they want to hear the records the way they remember them in their head.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't want you to be a mimic.
Right.
I want you to sing it like Jay Renke.
Right.
Like Jay Traynor and not like Jay Black.
Right.
Give them a semblance of the song because when people go out and sing live, there's always a nuance to it that's not the same.
Oh, absolutely.
Record, but be yourself. But, you know, we're giving them the real Jay and the Americans right now. I mean, we're more Jay and the Americans than not to point the finger than the other guy is because...
No, I understand that, too. Right.
You know, Jay and the Americans were this clean-cut American group.
Right.
We were the guys next door. We were the good-looking guys next door.
Well, I told you that in my collection, I have that album, you know, people don't even say that word anymore. That album, you know, Murray the K at the Brooklyn Fox, where you turn it over and there's Jay and the Americans in the upper right-hand corner of the album. And boy, it's a bunch of very, very clean-cut guys.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And that's the way people remember. And as a matter of fact, I was at that show. I was absolutely at that show, as were many other people. I remember it vividly, that show.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It was a great show. Murray the King was great.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, he was there was nobody else like Murray.
The Jay and the Americans, and it was not always hip at certain times in the history of the rock and roll business.
Right.
To be Jay and the Americans and be this patriotic, clean-cut group.
Right.
You know, at certain times it was negative and it was laughed at and it was kind of... Always thought that it's never, ever on hip.
Right.
To be patriotic or American.
Right.
You know, and we stuck to our guns and we built a legacy. And that's who we are, and that's the kind of show that we do. We represent the essence of the original group.
And as a matter of fact, you come out in Red, White, and Blue, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You come out on stage in Red, White, and Blue. You know, when I saw the red shoes, I said, they mean this. They really mean this.
That's right. We stand by what we represent.
They're not just kidding around.
Represent. No kidding around.
You know?
Yep.
But you couldn't wear those. I said to myself, but they couldn't wear the red shoes in Publix.
No. Actually, we probably could.
Yeah, down here. Well, it depends on which town.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, West Palm, you know. In South Beach, yeah, you could wear them.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah.
So.
They'd be chasing me for my red boots in South Beach.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. So what's in store for Jay and the Americans now?
Well, you got the new CDs. We're working on another one.
Well, let me tell you something. I played this CD already about 10 times. I just played it to listen to it the first time, and then I played it to really get inside of it the second time and the third time and the fourth time, and I listened very carefully to everything that was going on, all the guitar work, all the, you know, how you dealt with each song, you know, and it was great. And it's, and might I add, it's produced a little bit differently than the old stuff. I noticed that it has a certain different flavor to it than the original stuff.
Let's lock the door. Let's throw away the key. She hollers back with a glance. We are going to plot the master plan. The DJ played, she started to dance. J and A and the American band. Me and my boys, the 740 clan. She whispered in my ear, do you want to free that dance? And I knew I could be her man.
Let's lock the door and throw away the key.
It's different.
Music business has come a long way.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, you can go into the studio, and if you sing it well, you know, on the bridge, they can cut and paste it into the next bridge. You know, I understand that. Jimmy Gallagher and I were talking about that today. He said, you know, when he was with the Legends, they cut their first CD, and he says they wanted to do it all analog because they said they didn't. Digital is too clean sometimes, you know. It's
right.
Like, you know, so
very clean.
You have to be very careful about, like, how you present it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a science, you know.
We did a lot of experimenting. We did alternate versions on a couple of songs.
Uh-huh.
You know, we did "Walking in the Rain" the old way, the way we originally did it.
Mm-hmm.
We did "Walking in the Rain" with just guitars.
I want her. I need her. And someday, somewhere, whoa, I'll meet her. She'll be kind of shy and real good looking too. And I'll be certain she's my girl by the things she likes. Stars up above and be so in love. When she's near me, I'll kiss her.
One of the tunes you left a little count off on it, right? You had the drummer, you know, click and, you know,
yeah.
Two, three, four, you know, and that's sometimes very cool on some tunes and sometimes not. It just depends, you know, because each tune is a separate entity.
Yep. You know, we did we did Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by the old Platters song. We did that all way, you know, up tempo. What else did we do? We did that, that salsa beat with "Let's Lock the Door," the Latin dance version.
Yeah.
Right.
That was funny.
People email me from Sweden, from Australia, from
emails from Australia all the time.
Yeah, you know, because you know it's on the net now, and you know it's like that's the new deal. You know, people are listening like at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, across the world, the nouveau doo-wop groups and the young guys in Spain—they're springing up all over the place. They love this music, and they're, it's funny, there's a group called the Earth Angels from Barcelona. They sing the music, and they sound great.
Like the Japanese guys, you know.
Did you see that thing on YouTube singing Larry Chan's tune, the Japanese guys?
Yeah, it's so cool.
That's funny. It's funny. I told Larry, I says, you probably put him up to it. You know, it's like, but you know, isn't it funny about like this business and everything? It's like you meet the greatest people. I mean, there are very few people that you meet that like sing this music or whatever. And you say, he's cranky or he's this or he's that. You know, it's like everybody, they pull for each other backstage. They want to see everybody else do well. It really is a great fraternity of people.
Well, what it is everybody is fighting to keep the damn music alive.
Yeah, it is about the music. I mean, I see, you know, I think, and I see all of the politicking that goes on and the infighting, and here there are two Randy and the Rainbows groups, there are two Mystics groups, there are 15 Platters groups, There's so much like kicking under the table and politicking going on and whatever and whatever. It's really
it's
terrible.
Like it's terrible, but the bottom line is that there shouldn't be 15 Randy and the Rainbow groups.
I agree. You know,
shouldn't be 10 Drifter groups.
I agree.
You know what?
We have a fake Drifters group around the Chicago area here. I've seen them a couple of times and. You know, it's bizarre.
Did you see what Charlie Thomas did to one of those groups?
Well, he went up to them with the album?
Yeah. No, Charlie Thomas, they had a thing on, what was it, 2020 or something?
Yeah, after the show, he went up to the guys with the album. He says, do you know any of these guys or who they are? Or do you know who I am or whatever? And they said no.
Yeah, they couldn't leave. Well, we have a fake Drifters group here in the Chicago area.
Right.
And last summer I ran into them, and I walked up and I said, now, which one of you guys is an original Drifter?
Oh.
You know, and they kind of looked at each other. They said, well, you know, we play the songs. And I said, yeah, but that's not what I'm asking you. I said, are one of you guys original Drifters?
No.
You know? Well, you know, we love when you buy our music.
Right.
It's like everything is beating around the bush, and because they're called the legendary Drifters.
Oh, yeah.
They're not, you know, they're getting away with it.
The world famous Platters. I'll tell you, I did a couple of shows with a group called the world famous Platters. I asked them if they knew who Herb Reed was, and they told me no. So,
oh, right, exactly. That's my point.
You know, never heard of him.
Well, hey, yeah, exactly.
And that's pretty scary. At least if you're going to be doing the group,
you
better know a little about like the history of the group. You know?
Yeah, I made sure I learned all the history of this group, you know, before I was bidding on names, because I was thinking, oh, that's all I need is to have one of these guys come up to me sometime. But, you know, I was serious about this music. I love this music.
Yeah,
I
mean, he treats it with respect. He doesn't treat it like trying to be Jay Black or David Blatt or Jay Tra. He loves the music, and it comes across that he loves singing this stuff. He's not doing anybody a favor.
Right.
He's doing himself a favor because he loves to do it. If you don't respect the music, they shouldn't be out there.
No, I agree with it. And
don't have any respect for the music, or they wouldn't be saying what they're saying. You know, like they're original, because you know what, the people who made those records, besides the fact that they all got ripped off,
right?
At least should have the legacy of it.
Well, one of the things that Carl Gardner kept saying to me was, we never get paid, we never get paid. I was a dean in a junior high school in the Bronx for 30 years, and I had two kids that were not so great kids. One was Jimmy Keys Jr., one was Paul Keys. And Jimmy Keys from the Chords used to come in to Career Day and speak to the auditorium and tell them about the old days and about how he would have to eat on the bus. And, and the other groups could eat in the restaurant and the whole deal and whatever. And how, you know, he wrote the first crossover, you know, R&B, rock and roll tune, Shaboom. And how they never got the money. And he pretty much died penniless, you know, about 8-9 years ago. So, you know, I'm saying to myself, you know, that should not have been, you know, it's a whole different world now, you know. As the music lawyers run the business, I mean, you know, but
yeah.
I mean, it was a tragedy what happened to those guys, because you try to tell the new guys. I was even talking to Vanilla Ice about this, you know, like in the driveway. I said, do you realize that if it wasn't for those guys, there couldn't be these guys, because
right.
they set, I mean, you have to pay homage to the Orioles and the harp tones and Jimmy Keys and the chords and the Mills Brothers and the, you know,
and the
Ink Spots, so important. I mean, you know, really and truly, the Platters covered everything that the Ink Spots did. They were like the second coming.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, so, I mean, you know, there is, because when you take a group like the groups that evolved into the R&B groups of the 70s, that was, to me, that was just the continuation of the harmony groups, like the Intruders. They were a doo-wop group at the beginning, you know.
Sure.
So, I mean, you know, there is, let's say, a chronology of all of this stuff. I guess the most wonderful thing is that you guys are back again and the world gets to experience it, because the people that really knew that the original Americans were just pretty much taking a rest from this whole thing. You know, when Jay Black would go out and people would sit in the audience, the majority of the people knew that it really wasn't the original Americans, but they were and they were enjoying the songs.
Sure.
Yeah. Does Marty walk around with the guitar all day long, like even during the day?
Yes, he does.
Yes, he does. He sleeps with his guitar.
Because that is the most adorable. I got to say it. It's the most. It's probably like, you know, you guys have gotten over it already. But to me, it's like the most adorable thing in the world. He takes it. He takes it down the hall with him. He takes it if he's going to get it soda. He takes it into the bathroom. It's like. And what's funny is he'll walk down the hall playing and singing to himself, you know.
Absolutely.
And then he'll like nudge you with his elbow and he'll say, "How about this one?" And you know, it's like, and he'll sing like Stardust, you know. And you're going, yeah, that's it.
Well, the guys will be in the hotel room.
Yeah.
And we'll be trying to go over like a vocal part on something like this, and Mario, right in the middle of it, Mario grabbed the guitar and said, "Here, hey, remember this song?" And it's like, "Marty, we're trying to go over vocals." It's
no, I hear you.
Funny. He really is.
You're right. I tell you one thing though. He is his own person.
He is a unique troubadour. Yep.
You know, we love him.
He is a troubadour.
Yeah, but you know, Marty is a puppy that chews up your best pair of boots.
And then says what?
He just chews up, you know, like you love him, but he chews up your best pair of shoes.
And what does he say after he chews them up?
You know, like we're sitting in the room ready to go on, like 5 minutes to 10, and he'll be playing Stardust. I say, "Marty."
So what do you, I know what you guys do to warm up. You tell jokes. I told you, I thought I was doing a night at the Improv sitting. I was having a lot of fun just sitting there listening to.
Everybody says that we should be a television series.
Absolutely. And that could grow into the cartoon series.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
You know, the voice of Jay was done by.
Yeah.
You know?
Really? Mel Blanc.
Mel Blanc, yeah. Well, you know, Mel Blanc's son is doing all the voices now.
I was going to say, that'd be somebody doing the voice of Marty. That would be Mel Blanc.
Exactly.
You know.
Marty would be Felix the Cat.
Do you remember Felix the Cat, Jay?
I do, yeah. With his bag of tricks.
Yeah. Well, we used to go on the road a lot of times with a group. You know, we would play like old television trivia. But I mean, we would get really down into the, like, you know, like what was Chester A. Reilly's address, really get into like the heavy stuff. And it was like, whoa.
Yeah. Well, we were singing the song, the theme song to Car 54, Where Are You?
Oh, yeah. Tootie and Muldoon.
Yeah. Gunther Tootie.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, what's funny is I said to my wife the other day, you look at the movie, they're bringing back the A-Team now, because every decade, they do like a Superman movie, a Batman movie. It's like, keep bringing this stuff back, you know, for the new generation. And they just smack them in the head with it. The graphics are a little bit better. Now we're going to start doing 3D. The whole world's going to be 3D now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
3D television, you know. So
about a month ago, I was changing channels on cable and they had the Batman movie from 1966, the one where, you know, they have Catwoman, and they have, you know, the Penguin, you know, Burgess Meredith is a Penguin, and they have Frank Gorshin is the Riddler.
Right.
And to me, it's like I think of Batman on TV, and that was it. It was like, you know, it was so cool, everything like that. And now they've turned it into this dark, sinister.
Oh, yeah. Well, Gotham City was supposed to be pretty sinister and dark and had a cloud over it and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I found. Like you know, when you talk about kids and growing up and music and whatever and being a dean, that, you know, things, when I started, kids would come in and nothing was bigger than life. Their own lives, you know, they went out, they played after school, whatever. They played like 10 guys with a basketball or, you know, played some stickball or something. And then all of a sudden, things became bigger than life. So that everything that they were being fed was bigger than life, and their own lives got very boring to them. So, you know, it was like their own lives were never good enough. I mean, you know what it was when we were kids. Your mother would say, go out and play. And you went out and you hung out and you played and you could amuse yourself very easily because you didn't have all these high-tech things. You know, you just played. You went out and you played. You know, now everything has to be so damn sophisticated and bigger than life. Otherwise, you know, my life is boring. So it's tough, you know.
Oh, these kids today are incredible. Some of them, I'll tell you what. Oof. You know, I worked occasionally at a high school. I taught high school for about 10 years
ago. Oh, did you?
Yeah.
What'd you teach, Jay?
Spanish.
Oh, wow.
I'm fluent in Spanish.
Wow. You know, Paulette and I are going to Spain in July.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're going to have to
get... I know. The Spanish I know is probably more Mexican-type Spanish.
I had bilingual kids in my school, and I was very annoyed that they would teach these kids in Spanish. The Spanish-speaking kids, they would teach them in Spanish until they graduated, and they were socially immature because they never learned the language. And I would say, make them learn English. I knew I would walk into a classroom, and I would say, I knew two phrases. Siéntate, cierra la boca. They would go, oh, señor Dean, you know. And they thought I knew what I was talking about. I used to do hearings in Spanish. I would go, el knife grande, you know. And, you know, it was like, that's all I knew. I would do the whole hearing with body language. It's amazing.
Oh, my God.
You know.
Yes, yeah, I'm familiar with that, you know. As
oh, yeah, yeah.
You know.
You know, it's funny. Now that I need the Spanish because we're going to Spain and we're going to wind up in the wrong restaurant, on the wrong plane, on the wrong, you know, I'm saying we're going to have to do something quickly. We bought something similar to Rosetta Stone and we're going to have to look at it, you know. I marvel at some of these people that sing in different languages and everything. But see, now if you're fluent in Spanish, that's, you know something? Eureka, you should do like in a little cafe, the other side of the border.
You know,
sing it in...
Ironically, you know that...
Sing it in Spanish and do the backgrounds in English.
Un pequeño café caminando vi junto al río y al entrar unos ojos miré que me hicieron soñar. Mas de pronto escuché una voz, esta chica la quiere José, pero no hice caso a esta voz y con él ya bailé.
Ven mi amor a mi lado porque sola estás y te quiero a ti. Ven mi amor a mi lado, yo solo estoy si no logro tu amor.
Nuestro idilio empezó bajo un cielo azul y estrellado. Y en mis brazos vivimos los dos muy enamorados. Una música nos legó que el viento nos hizo escuchar. Con palabras de odio y rencor contra nuestro corazón.
Porque sola estás y te quiero a ti. Ven mi amor a mi lado, yo solo estoy si no logro tu amor.
In a little cafe, just the other side of the border. He was sitting there giving me looks my mouth water. So I started walking her way. She belonged to Batman Jose. And I knew, yes I knew, I should leave. And I heard her say, hey, come a little bit closer, you're my kind of man, so big and so strong. Come a little bit closer, I'm all alone, and the night is so long. Oh, we started to dance in my arms. So inviting, and I just couldn't resist her. Just a one little kiss, so exciting. Then I heard the guitar player say, was empty. And I heard Jose say, man, you know you're in trouble plenty. So I dropped my drink from my hand, and through the window I ran. And as I rode away, I could hear her say to Jose, yeah, come a little bit closer, you're my kind of man, so big and so strong. I'm all alone, and the night is so long.
Out there of
you already did that.
Some little, oh, no kidding.
Yeah, that Black did. But it's funny because we have that song Little Señorita.
Right, right.
Okay, well, I actually know it in Spanish.
Wow.
I learned it in Spanish, but we never cut it that way.
Wow.
You know, it's just for fun.
I think, you know what I think you should do?
Do that in a heartbeat, John.
I'll tell you what I think you should learn. I think you should learn one song in Yiddish.
Oh, God.
You could even do like Hava Nagila, no thanks, I just had one, something like that, you know.
Yeah, right.
But I don't, what do you think? I don't know.
No, no, you know, it's funny because the high school that I went to was predominantly Jewish.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, of course, I'm just a regular Gentile guy. But, you know, working with these guys is a riot. I have so much fun.
He's Jewish by injection by now.
Right, exactly right. Well, first of all, they all took Gentile names at the 11th hour. So it's like, you know, you're in good company. You know, you can go any way you want. Like, my name is generic Mike Miller.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, it's like nobody knows what I am. You know, until I open my mouth, then they say, we know where you're from and what you do. I listened to the Joey Reynolds interview, and I thought it was very cool. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. We have, you know, like I say, everything we do, we have fun. We really.
Yeah. I know Joey. He's crazy. Do you know Gary Lee Schwartz?
Why do I know that?
Gary, he was a DJ in Poughkeepsie with, they had the Solid Gold Jukebox. It was Rick McCaffrey and Gary Lee Schwartz for years up in Poughkeepsie. And so Gary's doing some things with Joey now. I think they're doing some things. But Gary is so crazy on the radio that one year I had Harmony Street and the Brooklyn Bridge, and we're doing a show, and John agrees to do the interview, and when he hates interviews. You know, they're going to do it live and broadcast it. John is eating in the dining room, you know, the restaurant, and Gary comes up to him with a live feed, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, we have the legendary Johnny Maestro, doo-wop royalty, you know, whatever, whatever, and, you know, say hello to your fans, John. And John, tell us, who do you think is uglier, Tony Bennett or Alice Cooper? and he sticks the mic in Johnny's face. Johnny pushes it away, caught him by surprise. He says, get this guy out of here, you know, let me finish my meal. So to which Gary Lee says, ladies and gentlemen, the legendary Johnny Maestro has just been rushed for an emergency charisma bypass. Well, I can tell you. So by the end of the night, everybody was laughing. John said, you know, let them record live off the board. Smitty says, you know, we'll punch in. And they recorded it all live off the board, and they made CDs out of it, which, you know, usually people don't do that because they don't, you don't know what's coming out. You know what I'm saying?
You never know what's going to come out. It's right.
Yeah, you want to critique it and whatever, nowadays people are recording groups and whatever, and you know, you turn around, you do a show, all of a sudden you're watching yourself on YouTube. You know,
yeah, we were, right? You know, that's one of the things I told Sandy back a few months ago,
yeah.
And we laugh about it now. It's like I said, do you realize that I am not allowed to have a bad performance ever?
Right,
because you know, the one night that you crack on something,
you bet,
the night that you do it. That's the only thing that's ever going to end up on YouTube.
Right.
Is the one night that you're not doing your best performance.
Well,
so we laugh about it.
You know, when you're doing a long show, sometimes, you know, some groups, you know, it's like they're drinking water, like during the whole show. It's like, you know, they have a little pouch on their side, or, you know, and they're drinking and slugging it down. I know I used to, like, put a couple of cough drops, you know, in my pocket.
In my tongue.
And I'll sneak it in. And so I had this conversation with Johnny Maestro a couple of years ago, too. I says, you do the cough drop thing? He says, yeah. But, you know, when you get a song that goes by fast and you don't get a chance to swallow or breathe, you know, and it's really going by fast, and all of a sudden you get that little drool that goes down the side, you know.
Yeah.
And you're up and you're belting it out, and there's this drooling because you got the cough drop. It does help.
Yeah.
With that little, you sing with that little bulge in the side of your cheek.
Keeps it a little moist.
Yeah, you know, it's all the tricks, you know, whatever.
I agree. It's another one of those little tricks that you just do, and you
okay.
know, even.
I'm talking to Marty of Jay and the Americans. Well, you know what's really funny about having the pleasure of working with you guys and being backstage with you guys is the fact that it's like so funny back there. That it's like a night at the Improv. I mean, I just had so much fun, and I went home with so many good jokes after those two nights, because I said to myself, this is like, you know, you guys could get up, sing one song, be funny for 20 minutes, sing another song, and go home.
Well,
it's amazing.
That's from growing up in the streets of Brooklyn.
No, I know that, you know. It's amazing to me, and what's really funny is that I sent Sandy. You know, I wrote a tune called Hushabye Again, and you know we did.
Right, we heard it.
Oh, you did hear it?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, you know that was with George Galfo's Mystics. You know,
yeah.
And I wrote that, and Collectibles picked it up. So you know, it's like, hey, I just keep popping out stuff, and you know, it helps me.
I got my song is in Kick-Ass.
Yeah, which is great. And
great movie. I saw the movie. It was really, really entertaining.
With no power comes no responsibility. Except that wasn't true.
But isn't that terrific, like, when you hear it back?
Oh, God, you know? And it was in a great scene.
Right.
So I went to the movies myself, and I sat there, uh-huh. And when the song came on, I yelled, yeah, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's me.
At the end of the movie, I waited for the crawl, you know.
Yeah.
And, of course, the songs are last. We're behind the cooks. We're behind the caterers. We're behind the copy boy. We're behind everyone. We're behind the guys who brought the sandwiches. The song, you know, and it was
It was the last thing on there, and I finally saw my name, and I was the last one in the theater.
And did you, Paulette and I always do that. We are the last ones out. I always watch the credits, because once in a while you see somebody you know, and once in a while, and you start seeing certain names over and over again,
right.
And you say, hey, you know, it's not just about the movie. I say, well, you know, this guy was the guy that actually directed so-and-so, and, you know, a lot of people don't care, but, you know, I like that stuff, you know?
Oh, my cousin Marilyn, I used to see her name a lot, Kenny's former wife.
Right, right. But, well, you know, I watch you on stage, and it...
Okay, because I'm flushing my toilet.
That's good, because that's the real stuff.
Well, you could leave the toilet flushing then.
Okay, it's all right. But we won't, you know, we won't bring attention to it. But what I wanted to say to you is that when I watch you behind stage, you know, it's that love of the guitar. And I do that too. I walk around with the guitar. I don't play it enough anymore, but I'm always with it. And I'm always, you know, like relating, in other words, thinking through the guitar, relating
to
it.
Yeah, no, I write musical. With it.
Right.
I sleep with it. I sleep with the guitar and a little old school tape recorder. You know,
yeah, but you know,
every quarter, and I write when I wake up in the morning. Sometimes I get an idea. And
yeah, but you know, it's when you have a point of reference. You know, it's like I pity those guys that don't have a point of reference, and they're musical in their heads, but they hear it in their heads, but they don't have a point of reference. I mean, with me, I've been lucky all these years, and you know how it is when you're sitting with a group and you're working out harmonies and you tear the chord apart and you say, here it is, it's right in front of us. And then you have one guy singing this note and he says, yeah, but I sang that on the street. And I say, but it's not in the chord. It's not in the chord. You are singing discord.
Right.
No. But it, you know, that's the way I sang it, but it's wrong. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's when I started playing when I was a kid.
Right.
I started because of Hank Williams.
Right.
And then I, you know, translated it into the everybody singing on the corner.
Right.
So, and those were such easy songs to learn, and that's how it started. I mean, I was
me too. I mean, I listened to The Ventures. I had a lot of Chet Atkins records, you know. I had a lot, I mean, everything guitar, you know. Everything
yeah.
guitar.
I, you know, so that's how a friend of mine had a Gibson. He had a rich parents, and they got him a Gibson. And I had a little pawn shop guitar.
Yeah.
One day I was on the beach playing my little pawn shop guitar, and a kid started talking. We were all sitting around.
Right.
And this kid was talking about his cat.
Uh-huh.
And I don't hate cats. In fact, I've had cats.
I like cats. I'm more of a dog guy, though.
He was going on about his cat for 20 minutes, and I lost patience, and I just turned to him, and in a passive aggressive kind of a thing, I, you know what I do to cats? I said the last cat I picked up and threw it under the wheels of a garbage truck and watched its head pop
under the rear wheels,
and he started swinging on me, at which point I picked up my guitar and right over his head.
You did not. But then, you see, but that probably led to a long career.
But it did.
You bought a new one.
I kept
a better one.
Neck. And I went to the, wanted a guitar like Bo Diddley.
This is funny. I kept the neck.
So I went to the Wretch Factory, which used to be in Brooklyn,
right.
The bridge there.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in. And I said, they said, what do you want? I said, I'd like to meet the guy, the manager, the plant manager.
Right.
And he said, you want a tour of the building? He said, I said, yeah, okay. And he showed me around where they were making the guitars, and they had the drum thing there and everything. Yeah. And then they said, listen, I'm here for a reason. I'd like a piece of mahogany.
Wow.
I wanted about 2 inches. I said, I want to make a solid body guitar.
Wow.
So the guy said, okay, we could sell you one. He walked me, showed me into a room, and the piece was like 10 feet long and was hundreds of dollars.
Wow.
And I said, no, I just want enough to make one guitar. He said, we can't do that. I said, come on, I'm 15 years old.
I want to make a guitar. Yeah.
And the guy said,
I have my saw in the trunk.
So he took it and he sawed.
Wow.
Off of me.
That's a great story.
And I went to my friends. I drew the outline of a guitar, and I cut it out on a bandsaw.
Unbelievable.
And then my father took the neck.
Right.
And he built this heel for it out of aluminum.
Unbelievable.
Bolted it on. I mean, they weren't doing that then.
Uh-huh.
And it came out, I got to tell you, I got a big piece of red plexiglass, and it was, uh-huh, wasn't Bo Diddley's square, his rectangular guitar. It was,
uh-huh,
one with the crazy angles.
Uh-huh.
And I still have it to this day.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And there's pictures of me with Jay and the Americans playing it.
Wow.
So that was like the first electric guitar, and I've got it here, and it still works.
Well, you know, I was saying to Sandy, you know, if you go on YouTube now, your whole life is on YouTube. I mean, there were YouTube.
You got, you know, on
stuff on the beach, stuff. I mean, I look at Kenny, you know, look like a baby, and
yeah,
everybody's like bopping around. And there was one where you guys are on the beach and you're kind of lip syncing, but you have a guitar and it's an electric guitar.
Right.
Yep.
It was either a Guild Starfire.
Right.
Or I was friends with, when I finally got to buy an electric guitar,
right,
a friend of my father's supplied Guild with electronics.
Uh-huh.
So he contacted Mr. Drone for me, Al Drone.
Right.
And he was the founder of Guild.
Uh-huh.
And they had their second, because they were built in New York first in the very early 50s. And the second factory was in Hoboken on a, uh-huh, river highway. And I took a train.
To the plane.
Two trains, and I made it up to the factory, and Mr. Jones showed me around.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some money, and he sold me a blonde single cutaway,
wow,
single pickup, Starfire, I forget what it was called. And he said to me, would you like, what are you doing for an amplifier?
Uh-huh.
I said, well, I don't really have one yet. He said, would you like this one?
Uh-huh.
I said, would I?
Hunchback, you know that joke?
And he gave it to me.
Wow.
And I then went home with the guitar and, wow, the amp on the train. I was in heaven. Oh. I was really in heaven.
And now that was the first Marty Sanders autograph series guitar.
No, that was just a regular. It wasn't much. I think it was a Capri with Guild when the group started up. You know, I still have one that they made for me.
Wow,
made one. Yeah,
that's great. You know,
I got all my guitars set up in my living room now. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 of them, yeah, set up, and made 2 or 3 others kicking around somewhere else.
I have right now. I have 2 Ovations. I have like the thin one, and then I have a bigger one that's an Adamas. But I just bought a 50th anniversary Strat, and it's really set up nicely.
Oh, those are nice.
And I use that to record with and everything else. But I had, you know, back in the old days, I had a pre-CBS Fender Jaguar, and it was stolen out of the back of my GTO.
You know.
They popped my trunk, and I bought one that was after CBS, after CBS took it over, and it was not the same guitar. It was like...
Back in the old days, yeah, I had a D-35.
Right.
I wasn't crazy about it.
Yep.
It had, you know, the D-35, I think, is Martin's way of getting rid of...
Some of the warped wood that they had laying in the back.
Wood, right. Like there's no reason for the three-piece back. It's more glue. It's more
It's
more stuff to hamper the sound.
Right.
And but I bought a D-35. I don't know how I bought it or why, but I did. And I wasn't crazy about it. Uh-huh. But it was about that time that we signed up Donald and Walter and were cutting demos.
Wow.
And they were in the studio, and they loved the guitar. So I loaned it to them,
uh-huh,
and they were using it,
wow,
and they were playing bass and keyboards for us on the road.
Yeah.
So we're on the road, and they hated my Gretsch. I had a Gretsch Country Gentleman.
Right.
No, I had a Tennessean.
Uh-huh.
And it never stayed in tune.
Yeah, but whatever they said didn't count then because they weren't Steely Dan yet.
Hey, I got to tell you, they had the name.
Uh-huh.
They had two alternate names.
Uh-huh.
One was Blow Lunch.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The other was Saya Fakanara.
No.
And I said Steely Dan is a great name. They
do you
know what it means?
Do you remember
that? Yes, I read the book. They said, you read it? You know, and they were so impressed that I knew where it came from. So what they used to do, well, they hated the fact that I was playing that guitar. They hated the guitar.
Wow.
So on the chorus of Let's Lock the Door, they
go
down a half tone.
Ah.
And I'd get blamed. Jay would kind
of
look at me and you know, and I couldn't imagine what the hell is going on. What's wrong with this?
Uh-huh.
And finally they told me, they said, when you get a new guitar, we'll stop.
That's really a great story. That's amazing.
I did.
I once asked Donald Fagen, I said, you know, would you please explain to me the words to Reeling in the Years and what they mean? And he said, I don't have the slightest idea, but whatever you think it means, that's what it means.
Hey.
I said, okay.
I said to them, listen, I got to have my D35 back. I want to use it for something. And they were in love. They were using it for everything.
Uh-huh.
So they said, okay. So I took the D35, and I went to Paramount Guitars.
Right.
Paramount, they were on 9th Avenue. They became WeBuy.
Uh-huh, okay.
And you know, Richie and what was their last name? What's their last name? Friedman.
Uh-huh.
And Mr. Friedman.
Right.
And I gave him my D35, and he traded me one for one. I got a Fender, a 1961 Fender Strat.
Wow.
And you know what it's worth today?
With a low serial number, probably.
I don't know what it had, but it was a great guitar.
Yeah.
And they said, so the next gig, I played that, and it stayed in tune, and it sounded great. It was an improvement.
So I'm having a great conversation here on the Harmony Street Show with Marty Saunders from Jay and the Americans. And notice we're not discussing Jay and the Americans because you know, talking about guitars is like really cool too.
Oh yeah, but it's about Becker and Fagen. So well, they wanted the D35 back.
Right.
And I said, well, I'm sorry, you wanted me to play get a different guitar than you know, than that Gretsch, that horrible Gretsch. Well, now I have it, and that's what it took to get it.
That's amazing. Well, you know, I have a lot of people that listen to this show because it's on so many, it goes out to so many people, and so I'm going to explain who Becker and Fagen is for those people who don't understand. And Walter Becker and Donald Fagen are the brain trust of Steely Dan. And Gary Katz, who happens to be my cousin by marriage. And, you know, I had the pleasure, actually, of sitting in at Soundworks Studio with Alan Raymer and watching some of the Asia overdubs. And that was an experience. He said, you can inhale, but you can't exhale until you leave. Be a fly on the wall.
Oh, yeah.
Very intense.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also told me one thing. He says, you know, I asked him, I said, it's such a light and airy and cooking sound all the time. And he says to me, that's because basically the rhythm tracks for Steely Dan are a click track and a Rhodes, and everything else is an overdub. So you could drive a truck through the spaces in the tracks, but it's cooking. It's cooking, but it's not like overloaded and overproduced. And I said, interesting.
Well, we've been having fun in the studio with Pepe Castro.
Uh-huh.
And we're working on a new song Sandy and I wrote. I wrote, actually, this past June, I got a few stents put in my heart.
Oh, didn't know that.
So people were asking me, were you nervous? What happened? Uh-huh. Well, I went to a doctor, and the doctor said, you know, I had some tests done. I said, you know, at some point we're going to have to, you got a little blockage, and we'll go in and put some.
Oh, man.
I said, when? And they said, well, somewhere in a month or so, or, you know, whenever you want to do it. I said, how about tomorrow? I like to put things behind me.
Wow.
And they said, okay. And they made an appointment, and the next day I went into the hospital.
No kidding.
So when I got out, everybody was asking me, they were concerned.
Right.
And I said, it's only a heart. And then I said, thank you, God.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Title, great title. And so I started writing the song, and Andy jumped in, and he helped me finish it. And it came out great, and Jay's doing a great job on it. And we did it with Pepe and in Pepe's studio, and it sounded really, really exciting. It's like if we channeled...
You channeled Roy Orbison, and
it sounds like a Roy Orbison song.
Sounds like a Roy Orbison song, right?
And it's going to be great. It's going to be really a good song. I don't know, you know. Anyway,
very funny stuff.
You know, we're rehearsing right now.
Yeah, I know that.
And
you're going fourth.
Yeah, I hope we could bust out and get some play on our new songs, and
you know, like. It's really exciting. Oh, everybody sounds like they sounded like a bazillion years ago. I mean, it's like everybody's right there.
No, well, I'm writing, and we got some good stuff.
Once you have found her, never let her go. Once you have found her,
I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. You must be like very excited to be back in full tilt with the Americans.
Oh, very excited.
You know, you're in everybody's hearts.
Great, thank you, man. The thing that amazed me the most with this whole situation and singing again was the fact that our fans never left, and it's been incredible to see them. And they show up. Places that you can't believe that we've worked at. And we have the best fans in the world. We just can't get caught up in a lot of the past stuff. And just got to keep focused on what we're doing and do the best shows we possibly can, you know?
I know. I mean, the story is such a great story. I mean, it's just a movie. It has to be done.
Well, you know, we're talking about it.
So I want to ask you a question that... that now, after the truth is out, were you the chick magnet for the group in those days?
Well, you think I make those stories up?
No, of course not. But, you know, I could see that happening. Everybody in the group has their own charm on that stage. And what amazes me is the comfort level of everybody on that stage.
Well, don't forget, we're all very close friends, too, so.
You know, I'm just telling you, I'm thrilled about the return of Jay and the Americans back with a new and improved Jay. And I think it's wonderful. And
thank you, man.
And
you know, if it wasn't for people like you rooting for us and backing us, it wouldn't be great. I mean, you've just been great to us, and I appreciate it.
But you have to understand how much it's my thrill, because, you know, you guys have been my heroes for a long, long time. I mean,
no
two ways about it. Thank you so much, Howie, for being a guest on the Harmony Street Show, and good luck to you and all the guys in the group, and you just have my best wishes, and I value your friendship.
Thank you, Mike, and I appreciate you giving me this little piece to put in this interview. It meant a lot to me.
Yeah, the same on this side, Howie. Be safe and be well.
Thanks, babe.
Well, Marty, it's been my pleasure, and great hanging out with you. And I want to thank you for joining me and the other Americans on the Harmony Street Show. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Mike, and I can't wait to see you again.
Well, it's been my pleasure tonight to talk to two of my heroes, actually Sandy Dean, who is an original American and started this group so many years ago and lasted through all the J's. Thank you so much, Sandy, for spending the time with me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. We had a good time.
And Jay Ranke, man, good luck, because you found them and they found you, and I think it's just the ticket to success, and it's just a wonderful thing. And, you know, as I say, I had the pleasure of working with you guys right off the bat twice over the last couple of weeks, and it's just such a super act, and I wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you so much for being on the Harmony Street Show. Thanks, guys.
Mike, good wishes.
I love you guys. You've been great. It was so great connecting.
Thanks,
man.
Mike.
Okay.
Yep.
I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, man.
Thanks.
Bye.
Good night. Bye.
Only just beginning. Ooh. World out your door if you just feel alive. Walk down the road and look to the sky. Life, it's waiting for you now. Stay a while, break a smile,
'cause we're all It's all how you look, what's going on, and you'll just be okay if you're feeling strong.
There's a world out your door if you just feel alive.
Come on,
walk down the road and look to the sky.
It's your life waiting for you, just go with the breeze. Trust in yourself and take care of your needs. Come on,
stay.
And life pass you by. There's a
world out your door if you just feel alive.
Come on, walk down the road
and look to the sky.
It's your life, it's waiting for you now.
Stay a while.
Come on, break a smile.
You're as old as you feel. Don't give in to the curse.
No, don't give in.
And we're here.
just beginning.
Well, there you have it for the greatest guys in the world, Sandy, Marty, Howie, and Jay Renke, Jay and the Americans. Gotta love them. Thank you very much, guys. We'll be seeing you soon. Thank you for listening to the Harmony Street Show. Keep listening. We love you. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can email me at harmonystreet@yahoo.com or go to my website, www.harmonystreet.biz. Good night.
Open up your heart, recall how it used to be, remember all the love we found. When we were feeling down and we were low, we looked into each other's eyes and found a road that led us to Harmony Street. We couldn't believe our eyes when we were there. Is it a big surprise to find we really cared? We looked into each other's heart and found the road was free and clear to Harmony Street. Yes, there were times when we had it all. Times when we both had our doubts, but through it all, you know, our love was complete. We spent all our time.